have received complaints about the resources I've been giving during the COVID-19 pandemic. I am not fear-mongering, and I'm sorry you feel that I am, but I'm happy that you are healthy. Skip ahead the next 30 or so seconds if the resources bother you. I've heard from so many of you thanking me for the resources, so here they are again. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you're experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you're suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233. Or dial 911 and just leave the line open. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. We all know these words, to have and to hold, for better or for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, till death do us part. But sometimes a marriage is irrevocably broken. It doesn't matter how hard you try. The trust is gone, and often so is the love. Sometimes you can love someone, but you can no longer live with them. And some couples can navigate divorce amicably, despite their reasons to split. For others, it's a nightmare, particularly if there is a custody battle. If you add in a drug or alcohol addiction, the sting of infidelity, maybe the devastation of financial ruin, you've got the perfect storm. For most acrimonious divorces, it's a prolonged court battle. And yet others take that till death do us part vow and refuse to let go. Welcome to episode 96, To Have and to Hold, the Kelly Cannon Story. The night of June 22, 2008, was unseasonably cool. In Nashville, typically we are headed to the upper 80s in the degrees during the day, often tipping into the 90s, and it doesn't go much below 75 at night, and it's usually fairly muggy, though we aren't suffocating the humidity of July or August, much less the searing heat. But on that particular June night, it was only about 67 degrees, and humidity was also fairly tolerable. It was nice enough that when Kelly Cannon arranged to meet a friend for dinner, she wore a long-sleeved dress over jeans and took a jacket. She also slipped on a pair of white Candy's Wedge heels. The 41-year-old mother of three looked like the wealthy and stylish woman she had always been known to be. A perfect size one, standing 5 feet tall, she had the sort of figure women envy. She's been described as willowy. But by this time in her life, her weight was plummeting below 100 pounds. She had lost that sparkle she was known for. A lovely brunette with brown eyes and a wide, perfect smile, she had been a beauty all of her life. She called her friend Amy, a mutual friend really, of her estranged husband. Amy took the call warily, already undressed, and settled into bed for the night. Kelly wanted Amy to meet her at the Bricktops restaurant on West End Avenue in Nashville at around 9 p.m. Amy had reason to be wary. Kelly had called her that spring, asking about her husband Jim Cannon having affairs. Amy had told Kelly she wasn't aware of any, and she really wasn't interested in getting in the middle. But when Kelly called her that June night, she sounded upset. She wanted Amy to gather up some girlfriends for dinner and drinks. She said she needed a friend. It sounds as if she wanted a fun girls' night, but that's not what she got. Amy got to Bricktops first at 9 p.m., She'd already eaten dinner, so she just ordered a glass of wine and waited for Kelly. There's no indication she actually called other girlfriends to join them. Amy later recalled that after she waited for a few minutes, Kelly called her and said she had cut herself shaving and needed to run to Walgreens for a Band-Aid, but then she would be right there. She came in around 9:30 and found Amy, also ordering herself a glass of wine. Bricktops is an upscale restaurant that serves all kind of food, but it's known for its southern cuisine. Kelly ordered mac and cheese and a slice of key lime pie. Amy noticed she was stylishly dressed, but had an enormous handbag with her. Kelly made an offhand remark that she was, quote, sort of living out of that bag. Amy told author Linda Rosenkrantz that Kelly just picked at her pie while she drank wine and raged about her upcoming divorce. Kelly told the server to bag up her mac and cheese for later. Amy said over the course of the evening, Kelly had about 3 glasses of wine. And despite how upset and depressed she had sounded on the phone, now she seemed really angry. According to Amy, Kelly said, quote, how dare he divorce me? He can't do this. I'm the primary caregiver. Kelly had been married to Jim Cannon for over 10 years and had 3 children. 2 boys, aged 9 and 7, and a toddler, her adored baby girl, who was 18 months old. Amy Houston, who would go on to testify later about this scene, did not just nod and say, there, there. She didn't take sides, and she certainly didn't rail against her friend Jim. Instead, she rather bluntly told Kelly that she should get a job so she could support herself. She later said Kelly mentioned having to pass a drug test. Amy had thought that Kelly's problem with painkillers and sedatives was behind her, but she was wrong, and Kelly definitely seemed miffed at the suggestion that she should get a job. Amy did say later that she still considered Kelly a friend and cared about her. That's why she got out of bed and came to meet her. And she truly hoped that Kelly would get the help she needed, but she was definitely uncomfortable with the situation. Amy also noticed a cut on Kelly's thumb. Even with a band-aid, she could see that the cut looked like it had come from a straight razor. Amy said that she and Kelly stayed and talked for about an hour. During that time, Kelly took a call on her cell phone. Amy only heard Kelly's side of the conversation, but it definitely sounded like she was fighting with her estranged husband. Kelly said, "These are my kids and you can't have them. They're mine." According to author Linda Rosenkrantz, Amy noted that Kelly didn't ask about her kids, what they were doing, or if they were all right. She thought most mothers would want to know about their kids first, but Kelly was just belligerently arguing with Jim. She said the call lasted about 5 minutes, and afterwards, she and Kelly only stayed at the restaurant for a few more minutes, getting the check and walking out together. Kelly was visibly distraught. As Amy said goodnight and walked to her own car, she thought she saw Kelly sitting in her car, talking on her cell phone again. Amy drove home knowing that Kelly was still in an agitated state, but probably hoped Kelly would go back to her apartment and sleep this night's drama off. She could not have predicted what news the morning would bring. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Kelly Elizabeth Cannon was born in April of 1967. She grew up in Green Hills, an area south of downtown Nashville, off Hillsboro Pike. While it was never incorporated and is a suburb of Nashville, Green Hills is almost a town in and of itself. It's one of Nashville's most affluent areas. The infamous Bluebird Cafe is on Hillsboro Pike in Green Hills, and the area is home to Lipscomb University, a private Christian college, as well as Harpeth Hall, a very prestigious all-girls school. Reese Witherspoon is a Harpeth Hall graduate. And so is Kelly Cannon. She was prom queen, in fact. Harpeth Hall and the all-boys school Montgomery Bell Academy in Nashville collaborate for many events, including prom. Kelly was also athletic and a cheerleader. She was known to be driven, vivacious, and sweet, and a lot of fun. Pam Brady, the maid of honor in Kelly's wedding, told Dateline that Kelly was as beautiful inside as she was on the outside. She later testified for her close friend. Kelly was the daughter of a plastic surgeon and definitely led a charmed life. She met her friend Pam after college when she applied for a PR writing job at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Evidently, Kelly called Pam a few times a week checking on the job. Pam was an administrative assistant who took her calls and they struck up a friendship. Kelly wound up working for the Tennessee governor's press office. When Ned McWhirter left office in 1995, Kelly decided to go to medical school like her father and two brothers. She even briefly worked in the medical examiner's office, assisting in autopsies, but she didn't like med school and soon dropped out. It was after she met Jim Cannon that she dropped out. James Malcolm Cannon, known as Jim, was born in January of 1965 in Nashville. He grew up in boarding schools, graduating from Brandon Hall School before Belmont University and Cumberland School of Law of Samford University. He worked for a while as a divorce lawyer, but didn't enjoy the work. He had invested in a failed pancake house and had to file for bankruptcy around the time when he met Kelly. And he already had one failed marriage behind him. But he is described as a gregarious man, outgoing, funny, with a wry sense of humor. And he had many friends. But people did see Jim and Kelly as an odd couple, because he was sort of ordinary looking. I've seen him described as plain. He just looks like a normal guy to me. As far as Kelly's good looks go, you can Google her. She was gorgeous. But even though everyone thought it was sort of an opposites attract relationship, they all agreed that the couple was very much in love. Despite his bankruptcy, the couple married in a lavish ceremony. Again, you can see these photos online. Once his bankruptcy was over, Jim opened a company called Medical Reimbursements of America. It was a company that collected debt for hospitals. Jim's new company was an instant success, and he and Kelly quickly adjusted to their new wealthy lifestyle. They bought a beautiful home on Bowling Avenue with over 4,000 square feet, worth about $600,000 at the time, and over $1 million today. Bowling Avenue sits between West End and Green Hills. It's definitely a swanky neighborhood. Kelly's mother, Diane Sanders, said the home was a fixer-upper, and she told Dateline that it was Jim who had wanted the house, and that Kelly did all of the renovations herself, or at least oversaw them. I've seen varying sources on why Kelly quit medical school. She has said that she never wanted her patients to come before the children she planned to have. She's also said that she quit school and never worked because that is what Jim wanted. He wanted her to be a stay-at-home wife and mother. Kelly is very much portrayed in the media as a trophy wife, a status symbol, and a socialite. Regardless, the couple did start having children, their first son in 1999, as Kelly renovated the beautiful home. She had another son 2 years later, but in 2003, she fell during some of the new construction at the home and broke her back. She was prescribed pain medication, which unfortunately sent her into an addiction spiral. Yet in 2005, Jim transferred full ownership of the home on Bowling Avenue to Kelly in a quitclaim deed. This was for practical reasons, in case of bankruptcy and for estate planning. If she was abusing prescription pills at this time, there isn't much talk about it. But she was a drinker, as was Jim. And in 2006, she had the baby daughter she had dreamed of. Her mother later said that she wanted a baby girl so bad she could taste it. So it seems to me that Kelly held it together for a while. According to Kelly's mom, Diane Sanders, Kelly found out that Jim was having an affair in the summer of 2007. She claimed that Jim eventually admitted to the affair, and Kelly started seeing a psychiatrist. She was prescribed antidepressants, which made her sleepy. Kelly had to hire a nanny because she couldn't get out of bed in the morning to take care of the kids. And her marriage was starting to crumble. Kelly went to see a divorce lawyer in October of 2007. Friends and Kelly's mother described a couple who engaged in screaming matches and continuously called 911. Team Kelly implies that Jim manipulated these calls to make Kelly look bad. And it bears repeating that Jim's attorney and his friends and associates never knew of any affair he was having. They knew he had a volatile marriage. They knew about Kelly's addiction problems. But there was no whisper that Jim was actually cheating. This is what Kelly and her mother said. By February of 2008, Jim had found his own attorney, and he filed for divorce on February 28th, but neither party pushed it. But Jim did also file for temporary custody of the kids, which was granted, as well as a restraining order against Kelly. The order specifically was to prevent Kelly from harassing or harming Jim, and to prevent her from abusing drugs and alcohol. By then, the 911 calls had escalated. In one call, Jim can be heard telling Kelly to put down the knife. Kelly's mother claimed to Dateline that Jim set her up. She said he dumped the silverware drawer on the floor and called 911 as Kelly was picking it up. Of course, this is a mother defending her daughter. There were plenty of other incidents witnessed by the kids and police. As far as harassment, Kelly called Jim incessantly, and once she called 911 and reported that her sons had been kidnapped when Jim had gone and picked them up from school. It doesn't get much more ugly as far as divorces go. And yet still, friends of both parties insist that both Jim and Kelly had always hoped for a reconciliation. For Jim's part, he wanted Kelly to get help for her addictions. He really loved her and didn't want a divorce. He just felt pushed by her increasingly violent outbursts. Kelly always insisted she never wanted a divorce. She would eventually have two divorce lawyers, but never answered Jim's divorce filing. She had also wished for a reconciliation. It was the fight for custody that finally pushed her over the edge into accepting the divorce was inevitable. In the filing, Jim asked to stay in the family home without Kelly so their kids wouldn't be uprooted. This motion was approved around the beginning of March 2008. So even though the house was in Kelly's name, she could not enter it or try to gain possession of it. I'm sure this added more fuel to her hurt and anger. To be fair, she said Jim was the one who cheated. And maybe she really believed it. The combination of drugs and alcohol can certainly create paranoia. You can see in her mind how unfair this must have seemed. But we know you can't see clearly through the haze of alcohol and pills. And Jim was always fair with money. He paid for her to have a condo close to their home. She lived at The Grove, a luxury apartment complex that was less than 4 minutes from the house on Bowling. He paid all of her bills without fail, and he did not cut off her credit cards. In this way, you can see Jim cared for her and was not malicious in his intent. I think he was doing the best he could. He and Kelly agreed that if she sought treatment for her drug and alcohol issues, she could move back into the home. This wasn't on paper. This was Jim trying to get her help. He didn't request any changes formally, but the dates on everything would be changed retroactively to the date that Kelly started treatment, if she started treatment. On March 6th, Kelly collapsed at a Green Hills Plaza and was taken to a hospital in an ambulance for fluids. She only weighed 90 pounds. After this, she checked herself into the Cumberland Heights Rehab, where she stayed for around a month. She needed to complete 60 to 90 days of inpatient treatment. But she checked herself out, insisting that she wanted to continue treatment as an outpatient. Kelly did move back into the house and later claimed that Jim refused to pay for outpatient treatment, a claim Jim's attorney denied. Considering he paid for everything else without complaint, this seems odd. And of course, he did let her move back in the house. I think she was making excuses for quitting treatment. But in April, she did start seeing a psychiatrist again, weekly. She was being treated for anxiety, depression, panic disorder, and PTSD. The psychiatrist prescribed a cabinet full of pills, from Adderall to Zoloft and clonazepam, a benzo med similar to Valium. so she was taking ADD meds as well as antidepressants, adding the drug Prestique if Zoloft wasn't strong enough, as well as sedatives. Mix that with the painkiller she was definitely still on and her problem with alcohol. It's a wonder she didn't accidentally overdose. I am not excusing her later behavior at all. And even the psychiatrist who saw Kelly later said he did not believe she was psychotic. An incident on May 21st finally pushed things over the edge. Jim had maintained Kelly's condo, even though she was back at the house. That day, Jim said that Kelly chased him with a knife as he was trying to call the police. She then shoved him to the ground and snatched his cell phone, removing the battery, but not before he talked to the 911 operator. Jim can be heard in the call saying, "She's holding the baby. It's just so pitiful. It's so freaking pitiful. She's a narcotics addict. She's a lunatic." He can be heard begging her not to leave and ordering his sons not to get in the car with her. But Kelly had put her 18-month-old daughter in the car seat in the back of her car and then rammed Jim's car with her own as he was blocking her in the driveway. When the police arrived, Kelly sped off. They chased her for about a quarter of a mile before stopping because she was going 70 miles per hour in a 30 zone. They didn't want to risk an accident. Back at the house, Jim's arm was bruised and his shirt was ripped, and there was damage to the rear bumper of his car where Kelly had hit it. Kelly was found by her car's OnStar navigation and was arrested for misdemeanor assault. Friends and family say she disappeared for a few weeks after this. No one knew where she was, but she was still technically living in the condo at the Grove. After this, Jim filed an order of protection on the grounds of domestic abuse, and he emailed his lawyer saying, quote, "Put a fork in me. I'm done. I want to proceed with the divorce." Before Kelly formally moved out of the house the last time, she hired a housekeeper for Jim and two nannies for the children. Jim let the boys sleep in the big bed in the master bedroom and often fell asleep on the couch in his office, or he went to bed in the lower bunk in the boys' bedroom. During those weeks when her friends and family didn't see her, someone else did, and she stood out in his mind. On May 29th, Kelly went to the Hickory Falls Bar and Grill in Smyrna, Tennessee. That's about a 30-minute drive with no traffic from her condo. She put in a to-go order and sat at the bar, drinking glass after glass of white wine while she waited. The bartender would later testify that Kelly was distraught, bitter, and angry, and she poured out her problems to him. She told him her husband was cheating on her and flying in women to see him. She repeatedly said if he tried to take her babies away from her, she would kill him. He testified that for a bartender, this was unusual and memorable. As a former bartender, I can tell you that drunken sob stories usually go in one ear and out the other. But if someone was making threats like that and behaving that way in front of me, yep, I would remember it too. He didn't call the police, thinking she was just blowing off steam. Aside from this bartender on May 29th, no one really saw or heard from Kelly. Her mother would later take many interviews, print and television, and insist that they had remained close. But later at trial, on cross-examination, she admitted they had been estranged during those weeks. No one saw Kelly until the evening of June 22nd, when she called Amy Houston to meet her for dinner and drinks. I'm going to pause to hear a word from today's sponsor. Like a lot of people, I can get really stressed, which fuels my anxiety. Are you feeling stressed? Maybe overwhelmed? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating anxiety, stress, depression, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. You can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you feel more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it's easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there's even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/southern. On the morning of Monday, June 23rd, the housekeeper and one nanny showed up for work as usual. They thought it was strangely quiet and started looking around. The housekeeper even picked up some clothes, including a bloody towel, and started a load of laundry. She noticed the house was really messy. She found a wine glass in the master bath that still had some red wine in it. So she started picking up the trash and took the glass to the sink. She also later testified that the house looked like it hadn't been picked up in 3 days, and there were empty alcohol bottles and beer bottles littered all over. She said she knew Jim Cannon drank daily, but she never saw him have more than one drink. This looked unusual. But still, at the time, she must have thought Kelly had the kids, because she told the nanny no one was home and went about her business cleaning up. In the boys' room, a chest of drawers was pushed in front of the boys' closet. The things on top had fallen, and drawers had spilled open too, as if it had been dragged or pushed quickly. She called for the nanny to help remove the chest. When they did, and the housekeeper looked in the closet, she found the nude body of Jim Cannon. She said his skin was dark, and his hands appeared to be the color of charcoal. She slammed the door shut and told the nanny to call 911. And then she thought about it and reopened the closet to make sure he wasn't still alive. She later said she did not want to embarrass him if she was wrong. But he was dead. Lividity had begun to set in. She also smelled the strong odor of bleach. In the 911 call, the operator tries to coach her on how to do CPR, and she bluntly says, "He's dead. It's too late." Jim's cause of death was strangulation, most likely with a ligature. There were also blunt force injuries to his head and abrasions from being dragged like a carpet burn. There was a bloody cell phone charger laying near his body. Police theorized that the charger's cord was used to strangle Jim. He also had marks on his face that appeared to match the plug-in part of the charger. It was later ruled that the force needed to strangle Jim wasn't much if a ligature was used. There was evidence of overkill, with more force being used than what was needed. He was strangled for at least 1 minute, possibly up to 3 or 4. And Jim had a lot of marks on his neck, evidence that he had struggled against the ligature. His blood alcohol level was 0.15, which is twice the legal driving limit in most states. So he would have been able to communicate and walk around, but with impaired reflexes and coordination. And it's certainly possible, if not likely, that the attack started when Jim was sleeping. The housekeeper called Diane Sanders, Kelly's mother, to tell her that Jim was dead. Later at trial, she said that Diane indicated she already knew he was dead. But the prosecution didn't seem to try and pick at this thread. Diane arrived on scene and cooperated with the police, telling them everything she knew, even about all of the times Kelly was arrested. And then she told them that the kids were probably with Kelly. The police went to Kelly's condo, and when she opened the door, they found that her demeanor was calm. The boys were playing a video game. Kelly didn't ask why they were there, and they chose not to tell her, but told her to stay put in the apartment to give a statement. She gave her statement in one of the bedrooms. She was cooperative and answered all questions, even offering more information, like where her car was parked. She also offered to come down to the station for an interview. About an hour into the statement, Detective Brad Putnam told her Jim was dead, and she reportedly became hysterical. But she had admitted that she had gone to the house on Bowling Avenue the night before to pick up her kids. She told the detective that Jim had felt like he was being threatened, that he was scared of someone. And then she decided to drive by the house that night after meeting Amy for dinner. She said all the lights were on and she walked through the open back door. She found her children, but claimed she could not find Jim, though she said she called out his name. She said she was scared, but quickly grabbed diapers and bottles for her daughter, then woke up her sons and headed out. She chose not to call the police. In heartbreaking testimony, the first witness to testify at her trial was Kelly's oldest son. He said that his mother woke him and his brother up and had the baby in her arms. She told them to get up and come with her. He asked her if he could get a pillow from his room, and she told him no. He said that he thought she was acting nervous and jumpy, and he was scared and confused, especially when she led the kids down the front stairs rather than the more convenient back stairs. The back stairs were close to the boy's bedroom, where he thought his dad was sleeping. The little boy said his mother said nothing on the car ride to the condo and also went to bed without a word. The next morning, when the police showed up, he assumed that his dad had called them to come and get him and his little brother and sister. His testimony is pitiful. He was cross-examined and asked why he thought his mom was jumpy and nervous. He said because she was, quote, on drugs and stuff. He also testified to the May 21st incident. He saw his mother chase his father with a knife and shove him to the ground and then get in her car. It all happened just like Jim said it did. Kelly was originally arrested for 3 counts of criminal contempt because she had violated the restraining order and the protection order when she came into the house and took the kids. This was on June 26th. But police kept gathering evidence. Inside the closet was the tip of a latex glove. It had Kelly Cannon's DNA on the inside and Jim Cannon's DNA on the outside. You don't get much more damning evidence than that. There were a couple of latex gloves thrown outside in some bushes that almost looked staged. Naturally, the entire home was dusted for fingerprints, and Kelly's attorney would later argue that of course her prints and DNA would be found in the home. She had lived there for a long time, but not recently, and one of her prints was found on the closet door where Jim was found. When Kelly was arrested, she was wearing a white tank top, dark blue jeans, and a pair of white Candy's wedge heels. When the clothing was tested, a mixture of Jim and Kelly's DNA was found on her jeans, and there were also bleach stains on her jeans. Remember, bleach had been poured over Jim's body as he lay in the closet. In her car, they found a box of latex gloves that matched those found at the scene, including the tip of the glove. I find the detail about the cut on Kelly's thumb to be so odd. Jim's time of death would later be put after the time she spent with Amy at the restaurant. She had called Amy to tell her about the cut, and then she had shown up with a Band-Aid. It would seem she did cut herself earlier in the night, and the Band-Aid just didn't stay put when she was strangling her husband. It's just one of those odd details that doesn't fit neatly in the story. Later, at trial, Walgreens security footage showed Kelly Cannon shoplifting rubber gloves. The timestamp was 11:17 p.m. She and Amy had left the restaurant at around 11 p.m. Kelly insisted it was not her on camera, but you can see clearly that it is. Kelly Cannon was finally indicted on September 2nd of 2008 and charged with first-degree murder. As you've heard, there were a lot of witnesses who testified at her trial. Many police officers, the lead detectives, crime scene analysts, and dueling medical examiners. The prosecution argued that while a lot of force was used to strangle Jim, it didn't require a lot of strength. He could have passed out within 10 seconds, and then all Kelly had to do was hold tight to the ligature until he was dead. Kelly's entire defense was that she was innocent, another person committed this crime, and that there was no way a woman of her petite stature could have killed a grown man in this manner anyway. It should be noted that while Kelly was only 5 feet tall and weighed less than 100 pounds at the time, Jim Cannon was also not a big man. Detective Brad Putnam described him as a petite man who stood 5 feet 6 inches tall, weighing 163 pounds. Maybe it would have been different with a large man, but with the manner in which he was killed, it probably didn't matter. And even the medical examiner for the defense admitted on cross-examination that there was a difference between force and strength. Phone records showed there had been nearly 50 calls between Kelly and Jim in the days leading up to the murder. Their fights and Kelly's anger were escalating. It may also explain why the housekeeper was so puzzled by the state of Jim's house. She didn't know him as a hard drinker, but maybe he had been upset and was drinking a lot to cope with all of the drama. From what Amy heard on Kelly's side of the call that night, it would seem that Jim had finally told her he was going forward with the divorce and planned to seek full custody of their children. And she knew it was coming. From the bartender's testimony, it sounds like he was already threatening to petition for full custody. And she had said she would kill him if he took her babies away. No one can be sure of exactly what happened that June night of 2008. But I think you can speculate based on the evidence. After fighting with Jim on the phone, before and after her dinner with Amy, Kelly made a plan. She went to Walgreens and shoplifted rubber gloves instead of paying for them. Smart enough to know a receipt would leave a trail, but apparently forgetting about security cameras. Then she crept into her home, what used to be her home. She claims that when she got to the house, the back door was open. But there was also a window that had been open that night. So she slips into the house and quietly walks over to her sleeping, estranged husband. She slips the cord of the phone charger around his neck, and before he even knows what is happening, he's being strangled. Remember, he was legally drunk and more than likely asleep. She might have been small, but a blitz attack like that on a sleeping drunk man would have worked. Then she drug his body to the closet and pushed the chest of drawers in front of the doors. This was another point of contention at trial. Could she have pushed that chest? The defense said it was 300 pounds, but the housekeeper later said she and the nanny had no trouble moving it. It was light, she said. But it doesn't matter. Kelly had just murdered her husband. Her adrenaline was racing, and she shoved the chest of drawers, knocking things off of it and causing the drawers to open and spill. Then she collects herself and walks into her baby girl's room and picks up her sleeping daughter. Then she goes and wakes the boys, and she drives her children back to her apartment. And then she waits to be notified of her husband's death. Another problem at trial for Kelly is that she admitted to being in the house that night and taking the children. If she had left the children there, she might not have been a suspect in her mind. Is that why she moved the chest of drawers? So when her boys woke up, they couldn't find their father's body. She obviously didn't realize she dropped the tip of her latex glove with both her and Jim's DNA on it. I think that's a distinct possibility. There is one thing we all know is true. Kelly Cannon loved her children. I don't think she could bear to leave them in the house with their dead father. In my mind, she does still have some humanity. She was in a drug and alcohol fog, filled with rage, and she definitely had some mental health issues. Yes, she killed her husband, but she could not leave her children alone and wait for the housekeeper and nanny to show up 8 hours later. It is interesting to note that not only was Jim Cannon found completely nude, but Kelly openly insinuated to several witnesses that she believed he was engaged in rough homosexual sex, bondage, and may have been killed accidentally. Had she left the children in the house, she would have somewhat had an alibi. Amy Houston saw her, and she could have claimed she never left her apartment after she left the restaurant at 11 p.m. Jim's time of death was put around midnight, But that's not always exact. And remember, Kelly had assisted in autopsies. She probably knew how hard it was to pin down time of death and thought Amy could be her alibi. And she knew enough about trace and blood evidence to pour bleach all over her husband and the scene. And bleach was found on her jeans, along with Jim's blood and her own blood. Of course, she would have been a suspect anyway. The spouse, and certainly an estranged spouse, always is. But the tip of that rubber glove certainly sealed her fate. But she didn't know she had dropped the tip of her glove at the time. Maybe she planned the murder that way, to look like rough sex that had gone wrong. And she pushed the chest in front of the closet so her kids wouldn't find their dead father. But she couldn't do it. She just could not bear to leave her kids alone in the house. Kelly Cannon is now 51 years old and is housed at the Tennessee Prison for Women in Nashville. She is eligible to apply for parole in the year 2061. She maintains her innocence to this day. Detective Brad Putnam said it was one of the fastest jury verdicts he had ever seen. DNA is stronger than a witness, he said. I don't disagree. DNA, even in 2008, had come a long way since O.J. Simpson's trial of the century. Juries believe in it. But as you guys have heard me say, juries also love circumstantial evidence. They need to know why. And the why in this case is very simple. Kelly Cannon would rather kill her husband than lose custody of her children. There was a plethora of circumstantial evidence to prove this motive. Kelly's beloved children are now 14, 19, and 21 years old. I purposely did not name them. I hope they have now found peace in their lives, despite what their mother did. Because by murdering their father and then going to prison, she orphaned the children she had wanted so desperately to keep. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you to Haley Gray and Jessica Ann for their research assistance in this case. You can look deeper into the case. There have been some interesting probate lawsuits, one in particular where Kelly sued Jim's aunt because she had possession of her little Bichon Frise dog named Sugar. And she also managed to sell the home before she went to trial. It did take 2 years to go to trial, so she had time for financial shenanigans. The financial lawsuits are dizzying, but interesting to some. And her mother is a real piece of work. I recommend articles in the Nashville Scene if you want to know more about her. They will be linked in my show notes. Don't forget to subscribe to Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast. I'm really excited to be working with Haley Gray's team, and by the end of May, you'll have two places to listen to me. And I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a lovely community, but no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage 3 platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.